from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this next hour, San Francisco-based novelist Daniel Alarcón's new highly acclaimed book, At Night We Walk in Circles, is set in an unnamed war-torn Latin American country. It follows a young actor performing in a provocative play called The Idiot President. Alarcón's first novel, Lost City Radio, was named Novel of the Year by the San Francisco Chronicle and the Washington Post. And the New Yorker picked him as one of their 20 under 40 fiction writers worth watching. Daniel Alarcón joins us to discuss his new novel and his continuing work as executive producer of the Spanish-language long-form radio program Radio Ambulante. That's up next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Peruvian-born and Alabama-raised writer Daniel Alarcón, now a San Franciscan, is the author of the much-praised story volume War by Candlelight and Lost City Radio, which won the 2009 International Literature Prize. His writing has appeared in Granta and Harper's and N+1, and he was named one of the New Yorker's 20 under 40 writers worth watching. He's also executive producer of Radio Ambulante. It's a Spanish language storytelling podcast, and joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. Good to have you back with us. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning, Michael.
In fact, last time you were here, we were talking about mainly about Radio Ambulante. I want to talk about your new novel now. Update us and tell us what's been going on in that world of radio for you.
Well, you caught me on a good day. Last night, we won a Simón Bolívar Prize, which is
congratulations! Yeah,
one of the most prestigious prizes in journalism, given out in Bogotá, and one of our journalists won for a piece that she did on human rights issues in Colombia. So we're super excited. We're doing great. We're finishing up our second season and starting to play in the third. Got partnerships now with the BBC Mundo, with Public Radio International, and producing stuff for the world in English. And, staying far too busy, I would say.
You can maybe mention how people can actually access it. And
Sure. Radioambulante.org is the best way to hear our stuff. And you know, the shorthand we always say for people who don't know what we do is it's something like This American Life in Spanish and transnational, with stories all about Latinos in Latin America.
Yeah, what about that? I mean, getting compared to This American Life and Ira Glass, I mean, on the one hand, you know, it can be heady, but on the other hand, it maybe can also take away, you know, here are these gringos and you have to be compared to them, that kind of thing. I don't mean to make it political. But
No, I think, I mean, you know, it's obviously a touchstone for us. It's a great show. And it's also just an easy way to explain what it is we do. You know, it's not more than that. Obviously, there's differences, and obviously there's stylistic details that set us apart from that show. But yeah, you know, they're friends of ours and we love the show. They seem to like us well enough. So as long as Ira and them don't get mad that we're using that comparison, I don't think it's a problem.
You have your own set of characters, you know, like Sarah Vall and David Sedaris, and the kind of people that have become sort of celebrities in their own right as a result of This American Life.
No, because we're not producing many of those kind of essays that they've been doing with Sarah Vall and Sedaris and those guys. Some, I guess, but yeah, we don't have enough of a track record yet to have those kind of personalities yet.
We have as many Spanish-speaking people here, I read, like 50 million, as in Peru.
55 million, so more
55
than
55 million, more than, yeah.
Yeah, far more, yeah.
Latinos.
And that's one of the things that I find interesting about it is sort of, you know, the project is integrating the U.S. and Latin America in a very specific way, and considering the U.S. part of Latin America. To me, that's very important.
Well, and, you know, there are many people who feel that there should be even more integration, not only in terms of trade and economics and all of that, but, you know, there's still the idea, especially when you get down in the Southwest, that a lot of that country really belongs to Mexico, or that there ought to be maybe even more greater agency for the Mexican government.
Well, you know, I think without getting into the details, for us, it's very clear that cultural boundaries are very fluid. So, you know, the U.S. is part of Latin America in the same way that, you know, Latin America is part of the U.S. And it goes both ways, and it's a conversation. And that's part of what our show tries to explore. Certainly.
So you still see yourself mainly as a fiction writer, though, don't you?
I think it fluctuates day by day. I mean, you know, for the next 6 or 7 months, and I'll be talking quite a bit about this new book, I think I will talk and begin to feel like a fiction writer again. You know, most of this book was finished, or much of this book was finished, you know, in stretches from 5 to 7 a.m. in the morning.
7 years.
7 years, yeah. And so it's at that in those particular hours of the day, certainly I was a fiction writer. But, you know, life is what life is, and you got to wear lots of different hats and do lots of different things. So sometimes I'm a radio producer, sometimes I'm just kind of an administrator of the project, and sometimes I'm a teacher, and sometimes I'm a father and husband and all those different things.
Many hats, a man of many colors, as Prince Hal was described.
Sure, why not?
But writing a novel, I mean, is, and particularly the kind of novel that you've written here, which we want to talk about, is quite a task that you set before you, whether it's 5 to 7 in the morning, or whether you're binge writing, or whether you're, you know, just writing whenever you can. And you said something once that has stayed with me. You said that writing a novel is like hunting down an animal and killing it. And if you let, I know that sounds pretty aggressive on the face of it, but you said, you know, if you let it sit a couple of days, it has a 2-day head start on you.
Yeah, I remember I got some hate tweets from some angry vegetarians about that comment. I mean, you know, anytime you're trying to describe the writing process, you're searching for metaphors. I do think that it is something you have to do every day. I think with anything that's any project that's on that scale, it's super important to just plug away at it, and that's basically what I was trying to get at. It is a slippery project. It is the story can easily get away from you, and if you spend a week away from it and 10 days away from it, and that it can easily stretch into 6 weeks and a month and 2 months and 3 months, and then it's very hard to dig your way back in, you know. So the writing spells that were most successful for me were the ones where I was pretty constant and diligent and doing it Monday through Friday.
Well, this is a story that takes place in a war-torn country, not a named country, but also really is told by a narrator who tells the story of somebody named Nelson. Mm-hmm. And has a lot to do also with guerrilla theater and with politics and with war versus peace and acting versus reality and so forth. Why was it so important for you to tell this story? What was it about this story?
Well, it wasn't this story originally. I mean, when you start a novel, if a novel is going to take you 7 years, it's inevitable that you're a different person by the time you finish than you were when you began. And this novel went through many iterations. It's the first solid draft was finished in 2010. And I threw it all out. You know, I started over. I kept maybe 8 or 9 pages and began again precisely because I was telling the wrong story. You know what I mean? I had gone down a very long 400-page path and written myself into a corner. And I started again.
What does that mean, writing yourself in a corner, realizing that you're not doing what you should be doing?
Well, realizing that I had... I mean, this is really kind of inside baseball stuff, but a very technical thing. I had quite literally created a situation for my protagonist where he had no options and there was nothing he could do, and he was not taking any decisions. And, you know, a character that makes no decisions is often a very, very boring character. And I was trying to narrate stasis in a way that was dynamic, and I was failing. And there was also a technical issue of trying to you know, tragedy and comedy can go together, but tragedy and whimsy don't really go together so well. And there was a kind of Rube Goldberg machine plot that was teetering. I mean, it was a mess. It was just a total mess. I showed it to a couple of friends, hoping they would disabuse me of this kind of pessimistic reading of my own work. And these very good friends of mine were very honest with me and were like, "No, you're totally right. This book is terrible." And so I started over. I spent the first 6 months of 2011 trying to decide if I should, you know, apply to law school or rewrite this novel. And I decided to rewrite the novel. And here we are.
So that meant a lot of rescaffolding, but telling it totally differently. And, I mean, this novel has real suspense to it. So you did get into that trajectory that you needed, presumably, decision-making, as you mentioned, and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, I the the parts of the novel that remain from the first book are relatively few. The tour, and I guess we'll get into the details of the plot in a little bit, but there's a theater group and there's a tour into the countryside. That was basically mentioned in a few pages in the first book. And the relationship, the most important relationship in the first version of the novel was Nelson, the protagonist, and his brother, Francisco, lives in the United States. And now, you know, that relationship is certainly a little bit more muted. And the tour is essentially the whole candle. It wasn't so much rescaffolding. It was just, you know, slash burn and start over.
Well, did you have the idiot president in the first draft?
Briefly mentioned.
Let's talk about that because that's central.
Yeah, it's a play written by a man named Henry Nunez. The basic plot of the play, it's obviously a political satire. The president of this country has a new servant every day, and the servant is tasked with, you know, attending to the whims of this very idiosyncratic tyrant, and at the end of each day the servant is killed. And so the idea being that this way eventually every citizen will have the privilege of serving the autocrat. So this play becomes central to the novel. Henry writes this play. They put it on for a few nights in 1985. A new president takes offense with this piece of theater, and the playwright is jailed for incitement. Spends 6 or 8 months in prison, and this whole episode becomes central to the life of Nelson, who chances to hear an interview on the radio with Henry Nunez and decides at a very young age that he wants to be a playwright and that Henry Nunez is his hero. Fast forward 15 years, when the play is revived, the theater group, this once famous theater group called Diciembre, is put back together. They do a revival of the play and they hold auditions for the part of the idiot president's idiot son. And Nelson, the protagonist of the novel, auditions, wins the part, and they go off on tour. And the last line of the first chapter is, "And that is when the trouble began." And indeed, that is when the trouble begins.
Well, and you also give us a kind of picture, not only of Nelson's home life early on and his brother going to America, but also Diciembre and the tour and what's involved in the tour. And what it's like after a country has gone through a war and the aftermath of that. I mean, there are a lot of elements that really cohere and come together. There's also a lot about prison. And I think I may be wrong about this, but isn't this that prison where Jordan Vandersloot was? Isn't it based on that in Peru?
Yeah. And in fact, he was there briefly. I think he's now in a much higher security facility.
There's the Castro Center. Is that what there's in Lima, Peru? Yeah.
There's two prisons that are very close to each other. There's Castro, and there's a prison that's known colloquially as Lurigancho. I visited and spent quite a bit of time in both. But in the last few years, I spent more time in Lurigancho and taught a 3-month writing workshop there in 2009. You know, visit every chance I get. Spent countless hours inside talking to inmates and visiting different parts of the prison and kind of gathering the history of the place. 2011.
Was that for the novel or just your own curiosity?
Well, that's
or
the
journalist
thing.
Side of you.
That's the thing, Michael. I mentioned earlier that you know when you start a novel, you're someone else than when you finish it. When I started the novel, in the first iteration of the novel, which I won't bore listeners describing, was bad and uninteresting. And at the time, I didn't know anything about the prisons because I hadn't yet done had these experiences. I hadn't been inside the prisons or spent much time there. And after 2010, when I threw out the novel and started rewriting it in 2011, I realized that I had all this extra information that I'd gathered, not because I was doing research for a novel, but just because I'm passionately interested and compelled by penitentiaries and by the prison system, and specifically by the Peruvian prison system, because it's unlike.
It's one of the worst in that whole region, isn't it?
Well,
it's notorious and infamous.
It is notorious and infamous. I hesitate to use adjectives like that, like worst. You know, I mean, there's certainly more violent. There's more overcrowded prisons in Brazil and Venezuela and Central American prison. I mean, you know, it's like it's hard to compare misery and pain in that way. And I try to avoid doing that. It's definitely a difficult place. And the thing that I'm struck by when I go there is how much responsibility the inmates have for basic improvements of their lives and for, you know, taking care of their basic needs. And given the context, they do so with quite a bit of success. And it's something that I've admired over the years, watching conditions improve. When I first arrived there, I got to say, it looked like something out of Dante. I mean, and I was...
The lowest rung of the inferno, I imagine.
Yeah, no, it looked absolutely terrifying the first time I went.
Daniel Alarcón here with us in studio. He's the author of At Night We Walk in Circles. His previous books include the novel Lost City Radio and a short story collection, War by Candlelight. And he'll celebrate book launch at Hotel Rex in San Francisco on Friday at 7 p.m. I'm going to open the phone lines because many of you indeed may want to join this conversation. And if so, we welcome your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. If you are a reader of Daniel Alarcón's work and want to speak with him, or if you want to simply join our conversation because we're talking about a whole range of things, and we'll talk about political theater and political theater subversion and catalyst action, and talk about war and peace. There's so much in this book that is really quite rich and right there for the reading. But in the meantime, we do like you to get involved in this conversation, and you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions, comments you might have onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. You might say something about the title.
Yeah, sure. At Night We Walk in Circles is a reference to a Guy Debord film called At Night We Walk in Circles and Are Consumed by Fire. Guy Debord is this French philosopher. I happen to read The Society of the Spectacle, and that's his most famous work, I suppose. And it fascinated me. It felt to me as I was working on a character like Nelson, who's into theater and who feels himself mediated through texts and distance from his own life. The idea of The Society of the Spectacle said something about this character that I was trying to discover. Later, the more I wrote, the more the echoes felt even realer to me. And precisely when I was investigating this Harper's piece that I wrote about the prison in 2011, I was able to spend a night inside Lurigancho. And I saw something that the idea of an after dinner stroll in a place like Lurigancho is men in the yard walking in circles, you know? And I really liked that image, and I liked the echo with this text that I'd already previously decided had taught me something about my character. And so there became the title. Plus, it has a nice ring to it.
Yeah, it does. And it's, I think, an appropriate title. Let's talk a little bit about Henry Nunez here, though, the lead actor and playwright. And his character, in many respects, seems to be born out of... did you have a prototype? Or did he just come sort of full bloom to you?
No, no one comes full bloom to me. The only way to create a character is to write scene after scene after scene and figure out what rings true and what doesn't, and revise and then revise again and then revise again. So he didn't come full bloom to me. Diciembre, the theater company in the novel, is based on a real theater company called Septiembre. And the characters of Henry Nunez and Pata Larga are based on two friends of mine, the playwright Walter Ventosilla, a Peruvian playwright who lives in New York, and Gustavo Lora, a friend who I affectionately nicknamed Pata Larga years ago. And I think I'm probably the only person in the world who calls him Pata Larga. And I can't even remember why that joke was born.
Pata Larga means?
Long legs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the joke in the book is that he's not tall at all. He's quite short.
Short, yeah.
But I used those two characters as models, I suppose, but then added a ton of stuff. You know, the whole idea of the artist being unjustly incarcerated. You know, there's plenty of examples of that. And there was a great a great film by a filmmaker named Ann Kaneko about the Peruvian art scene under Fujimori. And she profiled an artist that I really admire, a Peruvian artist named Alfredo Marquez, who famously painted a portrait of Mao with Marilyn Monroe lips, and was jailed for 2 or 3 years in Lurigancho.
Just for that portrait?
For that portrait. He was accused of incitement. And I've talked to Alfredo a couple times. We're not friends. We sort of move in similar circles, and I've seen him around. But I was kind of inspired by that experience, you know, of writing a piece of art that is, you know, what could be more disrespectful to Mao and funnier and more subversive than that? And, you know, these ridiculous powers that be misinterpreting and not understanding art and, you know, doing what comes most natural, which is to jail them out of fear.
Cool. See, I was also thinking in reading a novel of Shining Path, though, and you mentioned Fujimori. During his administration as head of Peru, there were a lot of those people who were, you know, essentially terrorists. I mean, they were wreaking a lot of havoc and anarchy. But, you know, what it brings up in my mind is that whole question about those who are really dangerous to the state or to the citizens, and those who are perhaps sympathetic or want to bring up change but are not necessarily violent but are just using art as a vehicle to change minds.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very wide space between, you know, the bloodthirsty radicalism of the Shining Path and you know, the brutal incompetence of the state. And there's plenty of room for satire in the middle without being party to either. You know, I think putting Marilyn Monroe lips on a portrait of Mao is making fun of the Shining Path as much as it is making fun of the state that is probably going to overreact. That's part of the joke. And they did. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think anyone like Alfredo Marquez or in my book, Diciembre, is pro Shining Path or anything like that.
The Shining Path were Maoists, so I guess just the association with Mao was what caused the problem.
Right, yeah. Right. I mean, if they'd put Stalin with Mao, with Marilyn Monroe lips, and no one would have known who he was.
Maybe they thought it was making him it sexy or something along those lines, I suppose. I mean, you know, you don't know what those kind of minds conceive of when they... But it's a whole notion of just how guerrilla theater and how political theater can actually incite and bring about potential real political change.
Yeah, but political change doesn't need to come from a car bomb, you know? I mean, there's lots of avenues for political change. And certainly... if you're going to make political theater in a place like Peru or even in the United States, you know, or basically anywhere, you can always count on politicians to give you material, you know. And I think, you know, The Idiot President is a play with a lot of resonance because a lot of us recognize our leaders that way.
Again, our guest, Daniel Kwan. His new book is At Night We Walk in Circles. And if you have something you'd like to add to the conversation, feel free to join us. Or if you're a fan of Ambulante or of his work, we welcome your involvement in the program as well. We're talking about, well, all kinds of things here, and we'd like to hear from you. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, the new novel, At Night We Walk in Circles. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. And Daniel will be celebrating his book launch at Hotel Rex in San Francisco Friday, 7 p.m. Join us on the program. You can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is Daniel Alarcón, and he is the author of a new novel called At Night We Walk in Circles. He is a San Francisco-based novelist, and also, the man who is responsible for Ambulante, I'll tell you a little, which is a radio podcast, and again, go to ambulante.org, and you can find out all about the Spanish-speaking, as he calls it for shorthand version of This American Life. The novel takes place in an unnamed war-torn Latin American country and follows a young actor performing in a provocative play called The Idiot President, and we certainly welcome your involvement in this program. You can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. I want to get a caller on, and John, that's you. Hi, good morning.
Yeah, I'm calling from the East Bay, from Castro Valley.
Yes.
Yeah, I was curious if the author had any impression he would comment about relating to the prisons in Brazil and relating to private prisons or commercial prisons.
Sure. I don't know anything about Brazilian prisons except what one reads in the news, and they don't seem like particularly nice places. The private prison industry here in the United States is incredibly troubling. Again, I'm not an expert. I probably only read the news that any other informed person reads, I find it just absolutely horrifying. It seems to me that that's antithetical to the idea of recovery and rehabilitation. So, yeah, I'm opposed to it. I'm not an expert in either of those.
Well, you did write, you mentioned Lourdes Gancho, you did write about that in The New Yorker, as I recall, and you wrote about this cell block, cell block 7, which mm-hmm. had its own culture, really.
Had its own culture, had its own government, it was for Harper's last year, and it was a fascinating, it's a fascinating place to visit because it's totally international. You have inmates from, I think there were 30 countries represented while I was there because it's a drug trafficking area of the prison. So you have people from the provinces, from the jungle, and you have, Polish and Israeli and Turkish and Brazilian and Colombian and Mexican inmates who are in for trafficking, Americans, Canadians as well. And so it has its own unique culture, and it also has its own system of democratic governance, and they have elections and stuff. And that's why I was there, was to observe the elections.
Let me bring another caller on. Sophie, join us. You're on. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I was just interested. I lived in El Salvador for a while, and I was curious as to whether you think that war is ever justified, or, I don't know, like, do you think peace will bring about any real change?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, as an observer of my country, an observer of Latin America, I don't claim to be an expert in anything. People can make arguments for, situations where violence was necessary, and I would just point to the results. I can't really support the results. You look at, Colombia with 50 years of war, you look at Peru with 70,000 dead. Mm-hmm. I don't see it. I don't see what it's accomplished. So no, I guess not. I mean, I think there are problems that appear to be insurmountable, entrenched corruption, concentrations of wealth, powerful and closed off oligarchies and all the things that we can point to, which by the way, happen here as well. And I don't know how to address those issues. I'm not a historian or a political scientist or anything.
But as a novelist, you make us realize that there's a big adjustment to peace too after war.
Sure. I mean, none of this process is going to be easy. And a lot of countries choose to adapt to peace by erasing the past. That's been part of the case in Peru. It's let's grow our way out of this terrible nightmare. You could argue that it's working. I mean, some people certainly aren't making that argument.
You read Vargas Llosa?
Sure.
You like?
I love the early novels. I think they're some of the most important books I've read. Conversation in the Cathedral. A wonderful book called La Ciudad de los Perros that was translated here is In the Time of the Hero. Tia Julia and the Scriptwriter is one of the funniest books I've ever read. The Greenhouse. I mean, he's just an incredible talent. I'm an incredible writer and certainly one of the most important writers that I've read.
He became politically pretty conservative, though, didn't he?
Well, to be fair, yes. I mean, he's politically conservative, but he's also socially... I mean, he's as we say in Spanish, consecuente. He's very much about freedom and liberty, and he believes in... in a lot of progressive issues, social issues. Economically, I think, you know, he's far to the right of me.
Well, you've been, just as a stylist and as a novelist, pretty heady company. You've been compared to Marquez and to Bolaño and even here on our American home turf, Steinbeck and Didion. What did it do to be named one of the 20 to watch or 40 to watch? No, under 40, 20 under 40. I want to get that straight. By the New Yorker. I mean, that was big deal, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, I was talking to my friend Adam Mansbach, and we were joking that we should start an alternate list called 20 writers under 5'7". You know, the point being the point of the joke being, you know, all these lists are pretty arbitrary. Having said that, it's nice to make that statement being on the list and not being, as opposed to being off the list.
Lest anybody think you're not under 5'7".
I'm 5'7", exactly. So yeah. I would be tops on that list. I feel like most of the writers I know are short, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
There's something about diminutive sizes.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't get into sports or something. But
Judy's favorite Indian writer, we think of Vikram Seth. Yeah.
Yeah. That particular honor came at a very difficult moment for me. I mean, in 2010, I was 6 months away from finishing a book that I knew was in trouble, and so that award or distinction came at a moment of really low self-confidence.
So this is another book you had to junk and move away from?
No, well, that award came in 2010.
Yeah.
I was finishing the first version of this book, which I ended up
The one we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Can you read from this book?
I'd love to, yeah.
A little, yeah?
Yeah, this is just from the early part of the book.
At night we walk in circles.
By the time Nelson entered the conservatory in 1995, the war had been over for a few years, but it was still a fresh memory. Much of the Capitol was being rebuilt. Perhaps it is more correct to say the Capitol was being reimagined as a version of itself where all that unpleasant recent history had never occurred. There were no statues to the dead, no streets renamed in their honor, no museum of historical memory. Rubble was cleared away, avenues widened, trees planted, new neighborhoods erected atop the ashes of those leveled in the conflict. Shopping malls were planned for every district of the Capitol and the old city, never an area with exact boundaries, but a commonly employed shorthand referring to the neglected and ruined center of town, was restored, block by block, with an optimistic eye towards a UNESCO World Heritage designation. Traffic was rerouted to make it more walkable, dreary facades given a dash of color, and the local pickpockets sent to work the outskirts by a suddenly vigilant police force. Tourists began to return, and the government, at least, was happy. Meanwhile, Diciembre's legend had only grown. Many of Nelson's classmates at the conservatory claimed to have been present at one or another of those historic performances as children. They said their parents had taken them, that they had witnessed unspeakable acts of depravity, an unholy union between recital and insurrection, sex and barbarism, that they remained, however many years later, unsettled, scarred, and even inspired by the memory. They were liars. They were, in fact, studying to be liars. One imagines that students at the conservatory these days speak of other things. They are too young to remember how ordinary fear was during the anxious years. Perhaps they find it difficult to imagine a time when theater was improvised in response to terrifying headlines, when a line of dialogue delivered with a chilling sense of dread did not even require acting. But then, such are the narcotic effects of peace, and certainly no one wants to go backward.
It's a very distinct voice, that narrator's voice. Can you talk about it? The genesis of it and who he was in your head?
Yeah, well he was nobody in my head for a long time. He was just something that I added and a question I had to answer. When I kept those 8 or 9 pages that I mentioned earlier, I started writing, and for some reason, as I was coming to the end of the first chapter, I added an I. And that I voice was suddenly talking to one of the protagonists without being one of the protagonists. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I didn't know what to do with it. So I just kept going. I didn't know how to resolve the question. So I just kept going. There's something that happens where if you have an open question for 10 pages and then you answer it, you know, it's not a big deal. But if you have an open question for, you know, 275 pages, then you better have a good answer.
Well, he sort of functions like a Greek chorus in a way, doesn't he?
Yeah, an orchestra conductor, you could say, you know, who's the person gathering this, you know, polyphony and putting it all together? Who's doing the work of telling Nelson's story? and why? I wanted that question, those two questions, who's telling the story and why, to be a second source of narrative tension. So when the first story flags, the other one comes in and keeps the tension alive. But it caused a great deal of anxiety, I should say. I just, you know, for me, trying to figure out who this voice was just a very difficult process.
And you went through a labyrinth with this, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did. I think I'm just happy to be out at this point.
You know, when you read that, you had what I would characterize as, and I mean this all respectfully, of course, a different voice. You had a different level of energy and vigor in your voice in reading that.
I like reading, yeah.
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 But, I mean, it comes alive for you again. It quickens something or ignites something in you.
Yeah, well, no, the thing is I read everything that I write aloud to myself anyway. And so when I read it, that's the way I imagined it sounding as I was writing it. And so there is a performative aspect to it, certainly.
You also write a number of instances about unnamed Latin American countries. Why do that? Why, I mean, you want people to guess or sort of fill in their own blank in terms of what the country
no,
would be?
No, not at all. Not at all. I want the freedom to tell the story the way I want without having to hew too closely to any kind of historical accuracy. I also think that it's...
Gives it a more mythic quality.
I also think it lets me... you know, the fact that it's unnamed doesn't mean that it's not specific. I think... it allows me to create a very deeply imagined setting, put it on the page exactly as the way I want it to be. Of course, it's based on Peru. I think there's no secret of that. You know, I was born in Peru. It's the country I know the best. It's the country's history that I feel most identified with. I mean, I'm not trying to be coy here. I'm just trying to give myself enough liberty, enough leeway to tell the story the way I want to tell it.
Born in Peru, but raised in Alabama. I mean, that's a fairly unusual pedigree, I would say.
It is. I mean, that's a part of my biography that always trips people up. They say, what were you doing in Alabama, you know? I mean, it's just one of those accidents of migration. My parents found jobs at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, as physicians. And
what was it, though, growing up as a Peruano in Alabama?
You know, it was a couple things that I remember now that I find interesting that at the time I just thought were normal. One was everything that I saw in Peru that I didn't see in the United States, I assumed was Peruvian. So, for example, Volkswagen Beetles were, you know, the dominant mode of transportation in Peru. You know, 7 out of every 10 cars in Lima were Beetles. So I just assumed that was a Peruvian automobile. I never played badminton in the United States. In Peru, I happened to play badminton with some cousins one afternoon, and I was like, wow, that's a great Peruvian sport. You know, so all these things that I just didn't understand. The only two places that I knew were Alabama and Lima. So, you know, if it wasn't from Alabama, it must be from Lima. And the other thing was, you know, people find this surprising too, but there was a small, you know, but fairly cohesive Peruvian community, mostly affiliated with the university. But, you know, we had parties, we had, you know, cousins, nuestros primos, you know, that were always around, and we lived in the same neighborhood, and we, you know, played soccer together and had sleepovers. And I mean, it wasn't a massive community, and I think no one else noticed we were there, but we knew we were there.
So. Make me think of Junot Diaz with the Dominican world that he writes about. Similarities? I mean, it's in New Jersey, but it's a kind of an enclave, really.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say we were an enclave. I mean, there was not enough of us to be an enclave. There was enough of us to, like, have two soccer teams playing at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah. Christine writes, I'm a vegetarian and in favor of animal rights, but I still love the hunting metaphor for writing. Don't drop it.
Thank you.
And Dennis writes, it is clear that Latin America in general has not realized its potential for achieving a satisfactory quality of life for most of its citizens, as the hordes of illegal immigrants will attest. Can you discuss your view of the root causes? And I'm sorry to offend, but my experience points to dysfunctional value systems.
I disagree with almost everything that was in that statement. Beginning with the phrase hordes of illegal immigrants. I mean, I don't think that I would question certainly the values of our leaders. I think, you know, the political corruption that one finds in certainly in Peru and other countries in the region is startling, and baroque. And, you know, yeah, I certainly question that, but I don't think that it's something, that's, that's endemic to Latin American culture. You know, corruption is everywhere. It just so happens that in poor countries, when you steal, when governments steal, when leaders steal, that hits people harder because there's no cushion. I have no doubt that leaders and politicians here in the United States are stealing all the time. It's just that this economy is so big that, you know, we can barely feel it.
Let me just read another email from a listener named Kate. She says, I'm a big fan of Alarcon's work, including his book, The Secret Miracle, filled with fascinating novel writing insights. Question, I've been away from my novel for several months by necessity. I just had a baby. I agree that it's essential to keep consistently working. So any tips for reentry? How to get back into the groove?
I owe a huge debt to the Headlands Center for the Arts. To the Headlands Center for the Arts and to the Lannan Foundation. Those two institutions were absolutely essential for me. Gave me time to get back to my book and concentrated time. I mean, if you haven't been away, I mean, we have a seven-month-old baby at home, Eliseo, who's probably not listening. So I know what it's like when you have a baby. You really cannot write. I haven't written anything since Eliseo was born. If you can find a way to spend even a week that's just with your book, then I think that's the way to go.
Just carve out the time.
I mean, I know people who have 9-to-5 jobs who take, you know, have 2 weeks vacation, take a week of that vacation, rent a house, you know, in some small town cheaply and go there and just hole up with groceries in the back, don't leave your house and do it. I mean, that's what I did too. I rented a house up in Ukiah. When was that? Maybe 2010. I can't remember. Yeah, that's the best advice I can give. I mean, if you can't win, have somebody be generous and kind enough to give you the space. I would say it's a worthwhile investment for your art to find the space yourself.
Do you have a lot of people coming to you for advice in terms of novel writing? You find yourself mentoring people? And
Some. And people send me stories all the time and ask me to read stuff and blurb stuff and you know, comment on stuff. And, to the extent that I'm able, I try to do it. I mean, you know, everyone's very busy, so you do your best.
Well, you're particularly busy, I mean, doing Ambulante and all the writing you're doing. You said earlier that Diciembre was based on a real political theater group.
Right.
Tell us about them.
Well, it was a theater group called Septiembre.
You just changed
the month. Yeah. A bunch of the members were from a town in Ancash, on which I based the primary provincial setting of the novel, a town that's called in the novel T. And I happened to meet Walter in New York in 1999. I didn't know any Peruvian writers at the time. I was living in New York, and it was he was really kind and really generous and you know, genuinely interested in what I was doing, and we arranged to meet when I got to Lima, and he gave me a bunch of his plays to read, including one called El Mandatario Idiota, which is referenced obviously in this book. At the time, you know, Septiembre was in kind of a hiatus, and they were performing in a house near the Plaza La Bandera in Pueblo Libre in Lima. And we went out drinking one night with Walter and Gustavo and a bunch of the other former members of the group, and that's how I got introduced to all of them. Shortly after that, Gustavo and I, the Pata Larga character, went on a long trip into the mountains to Ayacucho for about a month, and we became very good friends. And you know, he would tell me what it was like to go to these little towns and put on a show where you didn't know if anyone was really understanding anything that what you were doing, and yet you did it anyway. And you know, the times they were robbed, and the times they were questioned, and the times they had to flee a town before someone got upset, and the romances, and this and that, and all those stories, you know, one way or another, made it into this book. I mean, that was in 2001 when I heard these stories, And at the, and I, you know, at the time I didn't know that they were going to be part of this novel, of course, but here we are.
They gestate, right? They marinate or something like that. You know?
Yeah. And I find that very comforting. I got to say that you never know what's going to be interesting 10 years from now. And whenever I'm finding myself sort of feeling not too motivated by my context, I wonder, well, 10 years from now, what will I remember from this and what will be interesting? What will find its way into my work?
But that's part of, I suppose, the unconscious process of writing. I mean, you don't necessarily know sometimes when you even sit down and begin a story.
I never know.
It's kind of the fascination of it, isn't it?
I never know. And I think, you know, I write to find out what's going to happen. And when it goes well, you know, there's this magic happening where things appear on the page for no reason and the reason becomes evident 6 months later. When it's not working, you know, you take a draft and you read it and it's terrible and you throw it out.
But you have these writers who say, and I've never understood it, I mean, in my attempts to write fiction, as somewhat abortive and futile as they've been, you know, the idea that I can sit down and I can outline this whole plot and then just write it and I have everything written out beforehand in some kind of crystallized way.
I mean, that's like
the surprises.
Esperanto,
right?
To me, I have no idea
Esperanto.
How you do that. I have no clue how that would happen.
Go to a few more emails here. Mark writes, do you care to comment on Jose Maria Aguedas, who wrote about growing up in two cultures in Peru in his novel Rios Profundos, English translation, Deep Rivers? The two cultures are
Quechua-speaking
indigenous and the white, rich Peruvians. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Aguedas is a very important figure in Latin American. I mean, maybe in Peruvian letters is more accurate. Certainly an influence, certainly a writer that I identified with in certain regards. He used Spanish to dramatize the Quechua-speaking world in the same way that I feel that I was using English to write about a Spanish-speaking world. So certainly when I read Rios Profundos and his other novels that I like quite a bit is The Fox from Above, The Fox from Below, which is much more experimental and tragic and fascinating novel. I was able to see a bit of my own project in that.
Another listener writes, Laura, could you talk a little bit about the kind of education you desire for your son?
Yes, I guess I could. Yeah, I actually have been thinking about this quite a bit. I think at a certain age you've got to hew to whatever curiosities your children have and just whatever they're interested in, just put it in front of them and give them opportunities to explore those curiosities. I mean, the old saw about how the most important thing is to learn how to learn. I think that's important. And I think that comes from curiosity. How do you give students the tools to be able to self-motivate and to explore the topics that they find compelling?
Your own education was at Columbia?
At Columbia
University. Yeah.
Yeah. But before that, I went to this incredible high school in
Alabama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, I remember the last year I was just such a reader, and I was really interested in the Russians, and I was, you know, it was this kind of miracle of a place where I was able to propose a class. I proposed a class in Russian literature. I had a teacher who helped me write a syllabus, and we read Eugene Onegin, and we read Fathers and Sons, and we read Brothers Karamazov, and we read Ivan Illich, and it was just me, this teacher, and a Russian girl named Olga, and me and Olga and Raul, who's still a friend of mine, my teacher, would discuss you know, Pushkin. I mean, you know, that was better than any college class I ever took.
Think about discussing Pushkin in Alabama. So it seems quite exotic on the face of it.
Yeah, I mean, it is and it isn't, you know. I heard the Chilean writer Alberto Fuguet talk about how growing up in Chile, he felt that that The Cure was a Chilean band because that's the context in which he listened to them, you know. And I think when you're young, specifically when you're you know, adolescent and early adulthood, it's not so much that, you know, Pushkin is Russian. It's that you are who you are, and those that work is being integrated into your consciousness. And you're meeting that writer wherever you happen to be.
No Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, though. You didn't mention them.
Oh, Karamazov, yeah, of course.
Oh, I'm sorry, you did say Karamazov, yeah.
Shout out
to
Dostoevsky.
It had a profound effect on me. I don't know if,
oh,
I mean, as a high school kid, I read it as a high school kid also.
And of course.
Had,
yeah.
when Ivan says, you know, anything is permissible. you moved from Oakland to San Francisco, right?
Yes.
So maybe you want to comment on the two cities in terms of, say, Latino culture.
Well, I lived in Fruitvale in Oakland, and I love that neighborhood. I miss it. I miss it a great deal. I don't feel as connected to San Francisco, I think, in part because I haven't been here long enough, and it takes time to integrate into the culture of a city. I do feel like they're very distinct places. I love Fruitvale. I love the neighborhood, and I love the community there, and I love that everything was there, you know.
I can hear people in Fruitvale just feeling splendid to hear that from you. In our last hour, by the way, we gave the incorrect time and place for the Tech Awards. They were being held November 14th at the Santa Clara Convention Center, and you can actually join Daniel Alarcón celebrating his book launch at Hotel Rex in San Francisco Friday at 7 p.m., the book again at Night We Walk in Circles. So good to have you with us once again.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for the hour.
And Ambulante can be heard just by going to ambulante.org, radioambulante.org.
Radioambulante.org.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And we want to extend thanks to those who are behind the scenes here. Forums produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Chad McClymans. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.